Broadcast Studios. This is ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
Welcome to ABQ Connect, presented by Bosky Heating, Cooling, Plumbing, Roofing, and Restoration. For service, call 444-7200. Bosky Heating and Cooling, locally grown, locally owned. Thank you for joining us. We are excited to have our friend Paul Gessing, president of the Rio Grande Foundation, in studio. Paul, there's a lot happening in politics, my friend.
There is indeed a lot going on. How many hours do you have?
Well, I thought, the first thing that came to mind is, do you get a little vacation after November 3rd?
I will try to vacation a little bit after that date, but who knows, given the legislative elections and everything happening in New Mexico, it's not all that far time-wise from November 3rd to mid-January when the legislature convenes, and we'll know the scope of our work a little bit better, hopefully the evening of November 3rd. Hopefully it's not too many days after that, given some of the chaos we may be seeing in elections, and hopefully people are getting out there to vote early and that those votes will be tabulated. We'll know winners of a vast majority of the races around our state by at least the morning paper of November the 4th.
Well, and Paul, we're going to start the show today by talking about announcements that came out yesterday about some rollbacks that Michelle Lujan Grisham has again instituted for the state, and we're expecting maybe more tomorrow.
We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but yes, she just rolled back the closing time if you have a bar. Now, bars have been closed, and this is one of those goofy things that, if you have a bar like a nightclub where you really don't serve any food, you've been closed since March, 11th or whatever day she closed everything down. But if you have a bar that also serves food, you have been able to open, 25% capacity. And the fire code is a little more generous than a lot of people expect. So you can fit a decent number of people. That's a struggle for a lot of businesses and restaurants. But now they are closing them down at 10 p.m. My reaction was the coronavirus is like a gremlin, the old 80s movie, mm-hmm. Don't feed them after midnight, and they turn into those little monsters. Hopefully, this is impactful and helps. I just suspect that the virus spread after 10 p.m. is not much different than it is before 10 p.m., and it seems like something that's not going to help and probably is going to impact those businesses that have been doing a decent amount of work at that hour.
Well, and Paul, we have a lot of people that are restaurant owners that support this station, and we have other advertisers that have been adversely affected by the lockdown. So I think what a lot of people don't realize is it's not just your evening out. It's the waiters, the wait staff.
Oh, absolutely.
It's the owners. It's the inventory that people have gone out and purchased, and because they're open again and they're trying to get back to some normalcy. A lot of people making extraordinary efforts to do carry out. Kind of worried about a lot of these folks with tents and outdoor dining, still using them, but we're about to start getting cold, and that might be a little tougher to operate. So our prayers really go out to all the restaurant owners. We're very thankful for the people that continue to support the programming here at KNKT, but we are, in fact, all affected by this. And you have said it many times. You really want to see the governor have discussions about what she's going to do in front of us instead of just having Thursday afternoon press conferences and telling us what we're all going to do.
Yeah, and we're glad that at least the restaurants are not being shut down again, because you're right, with the cold weather coming, you're talking about massive investments in heaters if that outdoor dining is required. You're talking about restaurants again having to limit and get rid of food and products that are by their nature spoilable. There's other requirements that the governor put out there. She's limiting groups to 5 people instead of 10 people. And that basically accounts for my family. I don't think that's a very realistic thing. And I don't think many law enforcement officials really want to go harassing small groups of people. And 5 is not a big group of people. 10 was the number. Now we're down to 5. So six people out in the park somewhere. Just a lot of rules and regulations that thankfully overall in their real impact aren't going to change my day-to-day life a great deal and the day-to-day lives of many people here. But certainly businesses are further impacted. The ability to have hotels, they're saying that 50% occupancy is a good day for these hotels. Now the governor is taking them down, I think, from 75 or 80% to 60%. If hotels are somehow breaking through to that 80% number, they are having a great time. Most hotels are a ghost town. And I think it's an indicator of that people are taking this seriously. And even though they are, the virus still spreads. The virus is a virus. That's what viruses do. They spread. And the uptick we've had in coronavirus cases in New Mexico is just one of those things that's hard to fully understand. We've seen around the country, it's very hard to say that states that have locked down have done an especially good job in controlling the virus. This thing is not fully understood by human minds yet. We're still working on a vaccine. There's still a lot of information to be learned. And I'm not confident that killing our economy will kill the virus. So where does that leave us? It leaves us with no high school sports, no golf teams, no cross country teams playing this year. And a lot of young people who have already been deeply impacted by that, further impacted. Now, I'm not bragging, but I go play golf every week, and I've done so very safely for the entire 7 months of this virus. You can certainly play golf. You can certainly do cross country in a very safe manner with this virus. I don't see why our young people have to be subjected to the same, unfair targeting, really, on this. But yeah, it's just what we've seen out of our governor. And I think if you feel that she's done things the way they should be done, then by all means, vote for her and her compatriots in the legislature this session. She's not on the ballot, but if you think that there needs to be some pushback, you got to vote for legislators who are going to push back against her and not just ratify what she's done.
And we've got to observe that the incumbent leadership of this state has not done anything to take us off the bottom of the good list and off the top of the bad list. And if we had a basketball coach at the University of New Mexico that was always at the bottom of the conference, how long would they be our coach? It wouldn't be long. So I hate to use a sports analogy, but ladies and gentlemen, we've got to educate ourselves about the people that are running. We got to find people that are willing to work with each other on both sides of the aisle. We need to find people that are voting their values and having some integrity about what they do. And then those people will come in and serve. And I think they will turn it around. Paul Gessing's website is RioGrandeFoundation.org. There's a ton of information. You can go in and look at the legislative scorecard from this past legislative session, and you can see what all the incumbents did, who they voted for, how they did it. Mm-hmm. Now, some of them have been voted out. I know some of the conservative Democrats have been voted out of office. People particularly that were pro-life have been voted out of office. So you're not going to have some of the choices, even if you wanted to reelect somebody that has been currently serving. There's 101 new Republican candidates. There's an entire campaign called Respect New Mexico that the Republican Party has put forth, and the whole voice of that campaign has been, we need to turn things around. We need people with integrity. We need people with new, fresh ideas.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about that Respect New Mexico campaign, and that's not at all the Rio Grande Foundation being involved with it. I know a lot of the folks who are involved with it, and it is essentially a marketing and messaging movement for Republican candidates for the legislature here in New Mexico. And we've been saying for years that legislators running individual races is very challenging. They need to embrace 8-point, 5-point, whatever point plan. The contract with America from the 90s is a great model. And I think Respect New Mexico is the closest thing I've ever seen here on either side of the aisle to putting all your candidates up, taking firm positions and trying to move forward under that banner. And, you know, as kind of a libertarian leaning person myself, you know, Gary Johnson has left the Republican Party. He's a libertarian. He's run for libertarian office as a president of the United States twice. He's had some very choice words for the president of the United States, but he recently signed on to the campaign to Respect New Mexico. And that kind of endorsement from outside of the traditional Republican movement is an indicator that hopefully that plan and the common sense ideas have some, have broad bipartisan appeal. And it's, you know, we've been doing a pledge for candidates of the legislature not to raise taxes in 2021, you know, especially now. And we came up with a campaign back in April and May when who knew how long we would be shut down. The fact that now we're here in October staring at probably being locked down through the end of the year, I suspect, if not further. The governor said that we're not really going to reopen until a virus is found, and that's second or third quarter of next year. But we can't, you know, we've got serious budget problems at the state level. We know that, you know, we're going to have to do something drastic to address our government shortfalls. And the fact that people are considering and talking about raising taxes on the backs of small businesses and those families who have already been so impacted by the virus, we wanted to clarify and find that no, that shouldn't be done.
Paul, let's start talking about budgets. We're going to start with the city. The mayor, Mayor Keller, proposed, and there was a journal article you sent me dated 9/27, so end of last month, talking about recycling costs for the city of Albuquerque going up.
Yeah.
But there was something in that article I need to talk to you about.
Okay.
Because, again, I just love learning things. But if I'm asking you a silly question,
yeah,
I hope it's a question that our listeners have been asking as well. So the article seems to indicate that China has increased their price to us for processing recycled materials. And that's why we have to raise the cost of recycling to taxpayers in the city of Albuquerque. But here's my question. It looks like we are sending raw materials to China in the form of recyclables. We're paying China to process these materials, and then we're paying them to repurchase them from them. What's wrong with that scenario?
Well, it's essentially the square peg through a round hole kind of scenario. And a little personal history. My family, and I'm talking about like growing up in Ohio, my mom in particular, big environmentalist and always recycled from day one. So some of my earliest memories involve taking a bunch of materials over and taking them, sticking them in different bins, you know, glass and corrugated cardboard, et cetera, et cetera. Now, all recyclables are not created equal. There are recyclables that people will pay you to take. I'm specifically talking about corrugated cardboard and aluminum cans. Those are clearly, the market is saying, we want more of these. We will gladly take these. There are other products, glass. Glass has already been essentially banned from your big blue box that you put out on your curb whenever your trash is taken. The recyclable truck comes as well. And plastic, unfortunately, and that's the real kicker, is that plastic is not only dubious in terms of its recyclability, and like that's the one that they were sending over. So literally, China sends us stereos and, you know, you name it. So much of it comes from China. Well, you got to ship that on a boat to get here. You got these big shipping containers, and I think we all know what those shipping containers look like. They're actually one of the technological marvels of the 20th century because they made trade so much more efficient. Well, they're empty, and they're going from the United States to China. So that's when the recycling kind of took off as send it all to China, and they'll process it because their labor costs are lower. Well, China's not the same china as they were 10 or 20 years ago. Labor costs aren't as low. And quite frankly, recycling plastic is a very intensive and questionable activity from an economics perspective. And I uncovered, I was listening to, as I so often do, a radio show on NPR, and it talked about how the Chinese recycling plants would take in the top 10 or so percent of your recyclable plastic and then dump the balance, so 80-90%, in the ocean and rivers. So we've got this huge plastic patch out in the Pacific. Well, that didn't come here from the Rio Grande or the Mississippi. It came from Chinese rivers and to a large extent. And so this whole well-intentioned creation of recycling plastics, it really hasn't worked out very well. And I'm not saying I have a great solution, but I do think that the city, you know, we can, you know, start here in our backyard. The city should focus its attention and resources, because remember, we're talking big trucks, carbon emissions, employees. We saw a fire just a week or two ago when the recycling facility here literally caught fire. I don't know what the CO2 emissions on that incredibly black smoke were and how much that's impacting things, but you know, we should look at corrugated cardboard and aluminum cans and really focus in on recycling those because the market says they're viable. And then consider, you know, working with companies as a country, businesses, putting pressure campaigns on to try to address the plastic bottles and plastic recycling that is not really recyclable. At least if we bury it in a landfill, it's not going to wind up in the Pacific Ocean. We can agree that that's a better solution. So, you know, we're going to be paying, if the mayor's budget passes, 5.5% more on our trash recycling. And who knows if that's even going to solve the problem? Because ultimately, like I said, we need to reevaluate the entire system. And I'll mention one more thing. You know I'm a golfer.
Yes.
City golf courses, also in the budget, separate issue. But on the recycling thing, you go walking around the golf course, trash cans all over the city golf courses, Ladera, Los Alamos, they all sell beer. People drink on the golf course. Where do those recyclable cans go? In the trash can with all the other junk. Not even an effort to have a separate collection facility. So change starts at home. And if the city of Albuquerque, if the mayor want to do something to actually be green and do it in a way that's affordable and market friendly, let's focus on improving the recycling of those aluminum cans in our city, and to an extent corrugated cardboard as well. So that is my big plea, big picture statement on recycling. And I, like I said, I've been talking about this stuff, learning about it since I was a young kid.
Yeah. Paul Gessing is the president of the Rio Grande Foundation, and we're going to have Paul tell us a little bit more about the foundation and the research that he does. Great tool for you to prepare to vote. This weekend, October 17th is the first day for early voting, at least in the polls, and I want to encourage everybody to get out and vote as soon as you can. We're going to take a break, come back with more from Paul right after these messages.
Every day, children and teens will find themselves in the foster care system.
Because their parents can't take care of them.
Because of abuse or neglect.
They'll find themselves
scared,
angry, alone.
As a Christian foster parent, you can open your heart and open your home to a child or teen in need.
You can change your life.
To learn more about Christian foster care, call the Bear Foundation, 505-888-1362, christianfostercare.org.
I'm Rob Sneed, General Manager at Power Ford. If you're tired of old school gimmicks and games while shopping for a new car, then experience something new school at Power Ford. You'll get none of the hocus pocus, hokey pokey stuff the other guys try to pull. So here's the deal. We'll beat any new Ford deal in New Mexico, or we'll put $1,000 cash in your pocket. Come see why others rated us Best of the City and Ford Dealer of the Year. Find your ride at mypowerford.com or come see us. We're on the affordable side of Albuquerque, on Montaña, west of I-25.
Call 888-243-8183 for details.
God is love. God's love is intrinsic. It is as essential to God as light is to the sun, as blue is to the sky, as wet is to water. You don't make water wet, it is wet. In all of these cases, the attribute is intrinsic to the object. Take great joy in your God. He loves you. Hey, this is Pastor Scott Thom of Cross Christian Fellowship. Connect with us at crossfellowship.org.
The most important information anyone can receive comes from an understanding of the Bible. Only here do we find direct revelation about all things, about life and relationship with God. Life doesn't always provide us with time or opportunity to break away and study the Bible full time. That's why KNKT is dedicated to presenting round-the-clock teaching by some of the best communicators we can find about Scripture and how it relates to our lives. We need to be exposed to the full counsel of God's Word. And now, KNKT presents a Bible School of the Air. Each Saturday, starting at 9 a.m., KNKT will present Through the Bible, verse-by-verse teachings by Chuck Smith and Chuck Missler. Skip Heitzig, followed by a question-and-answer session with Scott Richards. We'll be rotating through the Old and New Testament, so drop into our Bible journey at any time and go through the entire Word of God with us. The KNKT Bible School of the Air. Tuition is free. The rewards are eternal. Take your seat Saturdays at 9 a.m. on 107.1 FM.
You're listening to KNKT. Welcome back to ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
So just like you can't get away from a show without me talking about basketball, you can't have a show with Paul Gessing without talking about golf. Golf is important to you, Paul. You've been able to keep some sanity by getting out on the course and enjoying some of the municipal courses. But yeah, there's always a budget issue. Golf is down nationally. What's happening with golf in our city?
Well, that's another interesting question. So much has changed with the COVID-19 pandemic. Of course, as you'll recall, way back when, March to mid-April, the governor shut down golf in the state for about a month, and they adopted COVID-safe practices, and people, to my knowledge, have been playing golf very safely for the entire time since then. And actually, they've been doing so at a very high rate. Now, you're right. Historically, golf playing had declined significantly, whether that's just cultural shifts or whatever it is. The data don't lie. The golf play nationwide has been down. You know, there was a uptick when Tiger Woods came along, and every, you know, tournament Tiger wins, everybody wants to get out and be like Tiger. So you might see a burst. And then the COVID-19 and not having the ability to do a lot of other activities, especially indoor workouts or whatever they're telling you to do, wearing a mask, et cetera. Players have flocked to the golf courses under COVID, but that doesn't mean that the golf courses in the city, and those include Ladera Golf Course on the west side, Arroyo del Oso, the Los Altos Golf Course, and Puerto del Sol. Those are the four main courses. There's kind of a facility over at Balloon Fiesta Park, also owned by the city. And the city typically, for things like that, justifiably has what's called a enterprise fund, where you try to balance the budget internally with the golf courses, because you're paying people to play, or people are paying to play. You have a lot of expenses, and you want to kind of keep that walled off from the rest of the budget. Of course, in government style, those walls don't work very well, and the golf courses have been requiring additional subsidies and money over the years for various reasons. So the mayor's budget just ends the charade and dumps the golf program, golf courses, into the general budget, where they won't be asked any more questions. There won't be any of this accountability. Now, we have a different approach, which is to further address management of the golf courses themselves through private techniques. If you go to the pro shop, you know, that's where you buy your drinks, you buy, you know, a new golf glove or whatever, you pay for your greens fees. Those are run by a private contractor, but the management of the course is run, you know, the greens and all the maintenance is run by city government workers, and those pay and benefits are expensive. The work rules are expensive. It would be better if they had fully private management of those courses that would then do things at a market rate with market level efficiency and probably break even or even turn a profit, depending on how much freedom they gave to these contractors. But again, it has to do with how you run government and how much efficiency you allow yourself to get versus you know, let's be honest, you know, government employees, while they do a lot of important things in a lot of important sectors, you don't need government employees to cut the golf course greens and fairways.
I've got a couple friends of mine. I won't name where they are or what they do, but they are contractors in city golf courses. And I know as short a time as 2 years ago, 24 months ago, the problem they were having is that those contractors get to run the pro shop. They get to give lessons. They have, you know, all kinds of public services they provide. But the city of Albuquerque wasn't watering the golf courses. So the courses were terrible.
Right.
So you're not going to get anybody to come in your pro shop if they don't want to play golf at the course. So it seems like your idea would be much better because they could then manage everything on a private basis, do it much more efficiently than the government or the city can do it. And we'd have a nicer place to play that might be a more reasonable deal.
Yeah, and the watering is one aspect of the maintenance of the city golf courses. And I don't even pretend to know because, of course, we're in a serious drought right now.
Sure.
I'm not sure how that relationship works because you've got the Albuquerque-Bernalillo Water Authority, and then the city is literally a part of that ownership of that water authority. What is the agreement exactly on the water and are the golf courses, which, you know, let's face it, it's a lot of green space for a desert community like ours. And that's a whole separate question that I, quite frankly, I just don't know all the answers to. But I do know that maintenance of those courses is part of the city's portfolio. It's something that city workers do. And yeah, it would be great if that maintenance could be done in ways that were more efficient, possibly better for the environment. You know, I'll say one thing, you know, I golf at all the city courses and you see, mistletoe in the trees. Now, I don't know if you know what mistletoe is. It's not just about kissing people on Christmas, but it's a fungus that'll kill the tree. And if you don't take care of that, then that tree might die. And that's green shade. That's, you know, CO2 oxygen exchange. Every tree, you know, is important to helping the environment of our city and our communities. And if you don't maintain that stuff, it will die and that'll deteriorate further, the golf course, et cetera. So, yeah, we would love to see some more innovative solutions at the golf courses. Other cities across the country, New York City, Los Angeles, my hometown of Cincinnati, all have done private golf courses. This isn't like some intellectual pipe dream. This is a way that deep blue cities, especially LA and New York, have said, yeah, the discussion probably went something along the lines of this. You know, we know that it's the elite, the wealthy elites who are out on the golf courses. Not entirely true. Trust me, but we can let those people pay their own way. We don't need to transfer over city tax dollars to prop up golf courses in our communities. Now, the actual reality is that golf does have a broad playership from all income levels and different groups. And to be fair, the city courses are very affordable, but that doesn't mean that your tax dollars, if you're not a golfer, should be paying for them either. And I think the private management model, doing it, continuing it as enterprise fund, but making the system work a little better would be a much better option than just kind of dumping into the whole budget and then unfortunately, inevitable cross subsidies that will occur.
Well, you know, you've answered a couple questions. You have some good ideas, but we've also brought up a couple questions. And here's the funny thing that I've had in terms of an experience as being a talk show host is I'll make some inquiries about the questions we just talked about, and I'll call the city. And I can tell you right now, they don't like me to call them and ask me those questions. And I have to say this. My heart is not to get anybody in trouble. It's to find out the answer. And why can't we just have a discussion? Why can't we have some other ideas out there? Maybe it'll help them in what they're doing. I have a little background on this. My father used to be one of the superintendents of the Albuquerque Parks and Recreation Department.
Oh.
And he came up with some amazing ideas. He started a program with his other co-superintendents called the Red Shirt Alert. So not only did we train our lifeguards well, but then they had to go through realistic scenarios. They called it a red shirt alert because a person would have a red shirt on and they'd fall in the pool and you knew that this was a drill and the lifeguards had to go over everything that they would do and the standard practices and they had to do it in front of the public. I mean, it was just very cool.
And probably like a young, you know, teenager we're talking about.
Yeah. And they would have these realistic training scenarios and that program is still in place. Started the Arts in the Parks program, which I understand is not full blown because of COVID and everything, but you would be able to go and see a play in a park. You'd be able to go see guys jousting and stuff in medieval costumes. You'd be able to go to an art show set up in the parks and just really neat things for the community. And what was funny about that is that the public knew all about it. I don't know anything going on with the city now.
Well, I'll give some excuse to COVID, but I agree that kind of quality of life, amenity sort of thing, hasn't been as common in recent years. I can't remember anything like that happening. I do remember they used to do a few years ago plays, Shakespeare, down on the city plaza, which I guess is technically a park. Mm-hmm. And that's wonderful. But yeah, I don't have all the answers for you except for, if you overpay for labor in a given part of your economy in this area, the Parks and Recreation Department, you're going to not be able to provide as many services because you're just going to have cutbacks when you're not getting your money's worth. And yeah, it's something that private businesses do a lot of. They try to be innovative. They try to get the best deal, best bang for your buck, but government just is not set up that way. And you have to have leaders like it seems like your father was, who will push through the bureaucracy because that can take a lot of strength and persistence and quite frankly, your soul from you if you get caught up with some of that bureaucracy and red tape and difficulty in doing these kinds of things that ultimately are huge benefits for our community. I mean, you know, there used to be, it was available to the public. It wasn't, aside from the facility being used, at the Open Space Center right up on Coors, the Astronomy Society, private organization, would do star parties. And you think sitting around looking in telescopes is a pretty COVID-friendly sort of thing, but that's not happening these days. And just like the Festival of the Cranes, the cranes are coming back soon, and that all seems to be canceled. So hopefully after COVID, we'll get a lot of this back, but it's going to be a long haul. This is not something that's going to happen. We have a vaccine. Boom, we're back at it. The budget problems, the serious economic woes are going to prevent a lot of this stuff, and it's going to take a while for organizations, private and public, to get back on their feet after this whole shutdown.
Well, when we come back, we're going to shift the focus to California, if you will, and a couple of issues that they're dealing with before we are, and maybe we can learn something from the way they are handling it. We'll be back with Paul Gessing, president of the Rio Grande Foundation, right after these messages.
The Great Mission features ministries making disciples for Christ. Many of these ministries are halfway around the world. Amigo Fiel is just down the road, south on I-25 in Juarez, Mexico. For more than 25 years, Carlos and Sylvia Garcia have provided a safe place for children to find food and assistance with homework after school. Amid COVID-19, Amigo Fiel continues. Here's Carlos.
Greeting from Amigo Fiel in Ciudad Juarez. We welcome the children. We're taking the necessary precautions to keep everything clean so that we prevent disease from being spread. We are experiencing a shortage of food, as his word says in Philippians 4:6. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be known to God.
Support Amigo Fiel. Click the Great Mission banner at star88.fm or knkt.com.
The COVID-19 global pandemic has disrupted everyday life in some way for nearly everyone on the planet. Yet Samaritan's Purse continues to share the eternal hope of the gospel and to serve in Jesus' name. We are trusting God as we make plans to collect Operation Christmas Child shoe boxes, just as we always have. during National Collection Week in November. Another great option to share God's love is to build a shoebox online. It's a convenient and personal way to give shoebox gifts directly from home. Build one by choosing from an exciting list of gifts, then adding a letter and a photo. We'll pack it for you and send it off. We want boys and girls around the world to know that God loves them and He has not forgotten them during this time of fear and uncertainty. Every gift-filled shoebox is a tangible expression of God's love. Get the latest updates and build a shoebox online at SamaritansPurse.org/OCC. That's SamaritansPurse.org/OCC.
This is a Fresh Thought. Listen up to Levi Lesko.
God has given us an important job of carrying the message of Jesus into the world, but we must never confuse the important job we've been given with a great inflated sense of self-importance ourselves, that we don't need to do the things that God has called us to do, and that the ends justify the means, and that we're able to do sort of what we want. Uzzah represents for us this sort of religious spirit. And Eugene Peterson puts it very well in his biography on the life of David when he says, Uzzah is the person who has God in a box and officiously assumes responsibility for keeping God safe from the mud and dust of the world. Men and women keep showing up who take it upon themselves to protect God from the vulgarity of sinners and the ignorance of common people. His death wasn't sudden. It was years in the making.
For more Fresh Thoughts, go to LeviLusko.com.
On KNKT, this is ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
We've got a lot more to talk to Paul Gessing about today on ABQ Connect. Paul is the president of the Rio Grande Foundation. Paul, tell us a little bit about the Rio Grande Foundation and what you do.
Yeah, the Rio Grande Foundation is an economic research policy think tank. So we look at the public policies in New Mexico, mostly at the state level, also at the local level, as we were just doing before the break. And we figure out ways to improve upon them, emphasizing free markets, limited governments, and policies that lead to prosperity for New Mexico families, which we believe that, you know, going home after a hard day's work with a paycheck in your hands is the best way to kind of build those families, keep them secure, and lead to improved outcomes across the board for all New Mexicans.
In our last segment, I want to talk a little bit about the bond issues that'll be up, just in general about how a bond issue works, where the funding goes, how that all works. But now I want to shift our attention now to California. They've just banned gas vehicles. This is not the only thing that they've done before anyone else in the country. They were one of the first states in the country to name cities like San Francisco as sanctuary cities. And I don't know if you've been to San Francisco in the last 5 years. I was there 30 years ago, and it was one of the most beautiful places around. But I understand now that the results of everything they've done politically in California have, for all intents and purposes, ruined the city.
Well, yeah, it's been a long downhill slide for a lot of places in California. And, you know, San Francisco still has many beautiful elements. It's a very unique town, but they've definitely been killing themselves with their public policies. And, you know, to be fair to California, their governor did not ban gasoline vehicles starting tomorrow or even at the end of this year. He's doing that in 2035. Which is going to have serious ramifications for that state and its long-term prosperity and economic impacts, because electric vehicles, quite frankly, don't make total sense at this point. Maybe battery technology will evolve quickly and it'll be ready to go by 2035. But, you know, the problem here with any of these technologies, from the gasoline engine to hybrids to batteries, and taking it all the way back 100 years to horses, there's always some issues. And, you know, if you brought somebody in a time machine from 100 years ago, when largely horse-drawn carriages ruled the day, they would frame pollution in the idea of horse manure lining your streets. And you walk down the street, and chances are you're going to step in something that wasn't long ago a part of a horse. And that's a real tangible form of pollution that affects you in a great, significant way. Not to mention the fact that a lot of people couldn't afford to maintain the horses. I mean, people who know horses and do that, that's a lot of money. It's a lot of time. So now we have this automobile technology and the internal combustion engine. And by the way, we've had a battle over internal combustion versus electric vehicles. They were a model. Electric vehicles were considered. But Henry Ford won out with the current internal combustion engine model. And yeah, there's externalities. There's issues with pollution. Cars have gotten so much cleaner. You know, LA, talking about California, the smog that used to blanket Los Angeles was intolerable, affecting your eyes, and the air quality was not very good. And cars are much, much cleaner. They're not perfect. You know, and going and getting the oil and using all the products that it uses in an automobile, there are environmental concerns. But I don't know that getting the lithium batteries and everything that's required in those, setting up new power plant facilities and, you know, everything that goes into that is going to be that much better when it's deployed on the kind of scale where we're, what we're talking about with automobiles. So that's all a fancy way of getting into the discussion that here in New Mexico, a year ago, our governor said New Mexico is going to be a 52-mile-a-gallon state. No car sold in New Mexico is going to be getting, well, the average is going to be 52 miles to the gallon. And that's not starting in 2035. At least Gavin Newsom in California put a hold on this thing until long after he will be out of office. He will be a U.S. senator from California or whatever he may be, maybe not elected at all. But our governor set us up for 52 miles to the gallon starting next year. Next year. She did this in the New York Times. It was widely publicized throughout the New Mexico media. Now, we haven't heard any details. Has there been an executive order? Has there been legislation? No, there hasn't been legislation in the legislature. So this is something that she would have to be doing through the executive process. But the average car on the road today gets 26 miles to the gallon. You're talking about doubling it in the span of just a year. I really don't see that coming to pass, but I do think it's important for us to ask and find out, again, transparency, openness. What is she planning for us, for car dealers, for the state of New Mexico? 52 miles the gallon, super aggressive. Even if she were to go to, say, 35 miles the gallon next year, that would be an aggressive standard given the current technology and current vehicle tastes. So I just think it's time for an update. And I know COVID's very important, but she did lay this out just a year ago, so it's not ancient history or anything. You could go back and read the New York Times article. She went up to New York specifically to do that. And what is the future of the automobile and internal combustion engine and battery-powered cars and hybrids and all those kinds of things in New Mexico? I think we all would like a straightforward answer on that.
I have an interview coming up next Tuesday. With the son of our former governor, Jerry Apodaca's son, Jeff Apodaca, who ran against Michelle Lujan Grisham in the primary for state governor, has some comments. And one of his, he doesn't really have any criticisms to offer about Michelle, except that he thinks a lot of politicians use New Mexico as a stepping stone to try to attain a higher office at the federal level. So maybe our governor is not expecting to have to enforce this plan and be on her way somewhere else. We'll see. We're going to take another break. When Paul comes back, we're going to talk about the election in general and what you need to prepare for and what you need to learn before you vote. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Michelle Garcia Holmes, and I approve this message.
Babies in New Mexico are aborted up to their date of birth. Some of these babies are born alive during the process. Our community needs to stand strong against this horrible act. This is not health care for women. This year, I'm voting for pro-life candidates like Michelle Garcia Holmes, who's running for Congress. Michelle Garcia Holmes will stand strong for life, and she will stand up for all New Mexicans' rights.
Paid for by Michelle Garcia Holmes for Congress.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, scientist and creation seminar speaker with the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, where do comets come from?
Chris, the short-period comets, like Halley's Comet, can make only a few trips around the sun before they completely disintegrate. Yet there are a number of short-period comets. Obviously, to support a billions of years old solar system, evolutionists need an inexhaustible supply of short-period comets. Thus, they had proposed a belt of comets called the Kuiper Belt orbiting the Sun near Neptune. They had no evidence of such a zone of comets, but figured it must be there to salvage their theory. Well, now we have the telescopes and spacecraft able to search this zone, and we found less than 4% of what they need. Thus, this dreamland of comets needed to salvage Big Bang ideas has been disproved. What hasn't been disproved is the creation story. That's the one that's given back in Genesis.
For more on creation, visit our website at www.icr.org.
From cloudiness to clarity, this is Roger Patterson with a minute of vision for life. Proverbs 14:8 says, "The wisdom of the prudent is to discern his way, but the folly of fools is deceiving." Bible teacher Beth Moore said, "Wisdom is knowledge applied. Head knowledge is useless on the battlefield. Knowledge stamped on the heart makes one wise." How does one get that kind of wisdom and knowledge that's stamped on the heart? You know, it takes time. Taking your time to journey with God while seeking His leadership should produce a patient pursuit that leads to a clear path for marriage, for money, for mission. Wisdom calls for a diligent pursuit of carefully assessing where you've been, where you are, and where you're going. Prudence calls us to see how it all links together because we have a sovereign God who's working through the valleys and the high places in our lives. Take your time and journey from cloudiness to clarity.
You've been listening to Dr. Roger Patterson with A Minute of Vision, a ministry of Vision for Life Radio at visionforlife.org.
On KNKT, this is ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
Want to welcome a new show sponsor, Ben Lucero and Indigo Mortgage. I really have a great quote here from Ben. He says that the decisions we make and the actions we take when nobody is watching but the Lord is his definition of integrity. If you need a new mortgage loan, please call Ben Lucero at Indigo Mortgage. His number is 505-836-5700, or you can go to the web at indigomortgage.net. I want to thank Ben for being a show sponsor. Paul Gessing, Rio Grande Foundation in studio. Paul, let's talk about what is at stake in this election, and with that in mind, what's going on with all this talk about the United States Supreme Court?
There is a lot on the ballot, and I know we're going to talk about bonds a little bit, but starting more towards the top, of course, U.S. presidents is always a critical vote, and who knows how that will shake out over the next several weeks. But we have right now in Washington, D.C., Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett, who is giving her testimony about her own judicial record and her personal background. So far, she seems to be very solid and a proponent of reading the Constitution as it's written, not trying to make things up that she agrees with and trying to push her own political agenda. One of the issues that's kind of come up in the whole presidential race and U.S. Senate race that really, I think, makes the Senate as critical, if not more so, than the presidency itself is the idea of court packing. And this isn't what I thought I would be talking about with a few weeks before the election, Jim. But court packing, if in my opinion, should be the number one issue people consider as they head to the polls. In 1937, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was frustrated because the U.S. Supreme Court had been an obstacle to his New Deal policies, a massive expansion of government, theoretically to deal with the Great Depression. We could talk about what actually happened and whether that was a good thing or not, the New Deal itself. But that's the last time this discussion got as involved as it is now. And, Democrats have not like the way the Supreme Court has been, among other courts, federal courts, have been moved to the right by conservative nominees. And, of course, President Trump getting a third bite at the apple, getting to nominate a third justice, is pretty amazing for a short four-year period. And the idea of court packing, and unfortunately the media is trying to change the concept of what court packing means to just mean that you're putting conservatives in the court. Well, if a position comes open, whether it's Ruth Bader Ginsburg's or some other judge at the federal level, the president is supposed to fill that. That is not court packing. Court packing is what FDR tried to do in the 30s, which is to add members to the court. It is not a constitutional requirement that the U.S. Supreme Court be at 9 members. It could be at 11. It could be at 13. And if the Democrats get a mere majority in the Senate and win the presidency, they have stated, some have stated clearly, Biden and Harris have not stated any opposition to the idea of expanding the court so that they can then insert their 3, 4, 5, whatever number of members and win liberal rulings on all manner of issues, Roe v. Wade and abortion, all kinds of religious issues relating to, you know, economic policies, Obamacare, et cetera, et cetera. But just you name it, they are at least unwilling, Biden and Harris, to decry the concept of expanding the U.S. Supreme Court when they take over to essentially get their way by swamping the court. Now, back in the 30s, I believe it's Stitch in Time, Save Nine, they did, basically the court acquiesced to large swaths of FDR's New Deal, and the court remained at 9. So it's been 9 since like 1860s. It's been a long-standing tradition in the United States that we've had 9 members of the Supreme Court. And the idea that Biden and Harris will not avow or disavow that proposal, that policy that's being pushed by a lot of folks on the left, really illustrates, I think, both how far to the left they are, but also the state of politics in this country and how, you know, it's almost like if you don't get your way, you're just going to take your ball and go home. And there's elements of that on both sides, but that's why we think that the Supreme Court and the possibility of having it packed ideologically to one side after the election is incredibly troubling for the future of not just the court, but our nation. I don't think you're going to get conservative states standing by and watching as liberals push their policies through the courts and rubber stamp them by adding new members to it. It's good. It could get, you think, as bad as the political debate is now. After that happens, it'll be incredibly ugly.
Paul, we also need to shift back to the election locally. There's a lot of state and city bond issue things that are going to be on the ballot. Tell us a little bit about bonds and how they work and how taxpayers ought to consider those when they vote.
Yeah, bonds are often way down the ballot. And, you know, you've got U.S. Senate race. You've got members of the House of Representatives up. You've got legislators. And those are incredibly important because all 112 of our legislators are up. And they're going to really guide the future of New Mexico and redistricting as well. So I don't want people to necessarily look beyond, but your eyes can't start to glaze over as you go way down the ballot. And there's judges, and people ask me all the time about judges, and it's a convoluted and very strange process. And if you want to find out more information, drop us an email, info@riograndefoundation.org, info@riograndefoundation.org. We'll do our best to guide you through on some of those judge issues. But bonds are debt that the government uses to build projects that are either worthwhile or sometimes of dubious benefit to our community. And, you know, Mayor Keller, in the last city election, so I guess last November, he, unfortunately, one of the problems with bonds is that the language is often so broad that's on the ballot. It sounds like you're paying for mom, apple pie, veterans, and all good things with these bonds. But they often hide the real language and uses for those bond dollars in background documents. And one of the things that we voted on that didn't seem like it was for that, but in the last election, there was a homeless facility that wound up being paid for by bonds. So it's essentially debt that the government takes on. Could be the state government, could be local, city, county, and they then build things. They maintain roads, which all of us generally agree with. They maintain senior centers, which are also a good thing, but they often can manipulate what they use those dollars for in ways that are not readily apparent on the ballot. And the, you know, you're paying that money back through your property taxes, generally speaking. Sometimes gross receipts taxes are used to pay that back as well, but it is a way that governments finance large numbers of public works projects because, you know, like most people don't buy their house cash on the barrel. You know, you take out a 30-year mortgage. That's the idea. These are public works projects. They are things that are going to last. They're tangible for a long time. So you don't necessarily build them all at once or pay for them all at once. You finance it over a relatively longer period, and that's how you you get those things. And bonds are useful, but I would just encourage folks to take a really close look at various bonds that are on the ballot, and don't just go down and vote yes for all of them. For example, higher education. Right now, higher education is in chaos in New Mexico because of COVID-19, but we also have a system that has so many branch campuses, so many is spread so thin geographically and in terms of what they try to do that it's questionable what they actually achieve in some respects on the areas where they're actually supposed to be educating our young people for jobs in the next generation. There's a higher ed bond. It's the biggest statewide bond on the ballot in terms of dollars. It's over $100 million. It's a significant expenditure of money, and it'll be something that you pay for through your property taxes. And that one, I think higher education in particular needs to be reconsidered, reimagined, consolidated, and streamlined. And when you vote yes, just blindly across the board on these bonds, you tend to get more of the same, not changes, not reevaluations of how they do things.
As you talk, Paul, I can't help but express my opinion. My son is an auditor. And if there was a line item on an audit statement, a financial statement that he was auditing, where they misstated what the expense was for or what the money was for, that would be called fraud.
Right.
So the fact that in our legislature and in our on our ballots, they're able to disguise, for lack of a better term, what this money's actually going to be used for, that's not transparency in government.
No. No. And it may not be outright fraud. I'm not a legal expert nor an accountant. I didn't want to that wasn't my choice in life to be involved in that. But it does need to be clarified, I think, ahead of time with the voters what exactly those dollars are going to be used for with those bonds. And it's important for good government. Absolutely.
Paul, last question. Are the ideas of our forefathers about what they wrote in the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the forming of a democratic republic, the establishing of three independent branches of government, are these ideas and the things that have been implemented in this country to hold self-interest in check, are these ideas just outdated now?
Absolutely not. These are the foundational principles of our republic, and it is a republic. There are democratic aspects, small d aspects to our nation, but everything from the First Amendment to the Electoral College to the way senators are elected has principles that are, you know, protecting the interests of the minority, whoever they may be. And I think people on both sides of the aisle who really take a close look will understand the genius of the American system, and they should want to preserve and extend it, not to undermine it. And, court packing is one of the ways in which our system could be seriously undermined. There's a lot of other ways. We need to be vigilant, and we need to do what we can to preserve the benefits of America.
Paul Gessing, happy election, my friend, here in a couple weeks.
Yeah, I think we'll see you right before the election, but I suspect that most people will have voted by then. I've encouraged people not to vote, not to wait till election day, to
yes.
Go ahead and vote early. That starts this Saturday, by all means, with the various sites across our city and state, no longer limited to the clerk's office. So get out there, go vote, and preserve that Democratic Republic.
ABQ Connect is presented by Bosky Heating and Cooling. For service, call 504-444-7200. Bosky Heating and Cooling. Locally grown, locally owned. ABQ Connect with Jim Williams is a production of KNKT. The views expressed on ABQ Connect do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of KNKT. If you missed any or part of today's show, get the free podcast at abqconnect.online.